Washington, D.C. newspaper called The Hill. It's also a website, thehill.com. And it's called, the title is, DNC must ban every corporate dollar or risk total irrelevancy. And I'll post the link of the article at the site for this podcast segment on the Working Life site, but obviously you can search it yourself at The Hill. Now, you get the point of this article just from the title, I reckon. The DNC has to stop taking corporate money, period. Which is a good segue to my next guest. So, if the Democrats are going to take control of the House in 2018, they will likely have to win, perhaps, up to half a dozen races just in California. And one of those races is in the 49th Congressional District, which is in the southern part of the state, just north of San Diego. And one of the things that particularly is identifiable in that district is the huge Camp Pendleton, a military base within the district. The current representative is the odious Darrell Issa. You probably have come upon him on C-SPAN and watched him rant and rave in his odious way. And in 2016, he actually was almost defeated by Colonel Doug Applegate. The margin was only 1,600 votes between them, and actually the percentage was 50.3% for Issa to 49.7% for Doug Applegate. And so you got a figure in the current state of affairs, Applegate, who's taking another run at Issa, is probably running one of the higher profile races against probably a very, very vulnerable Republican. So Applegate, in fact, served in the Marine Corps, mostly in the role of an attorney, both on the defense side and the prosecution side. And after a combat tour in Iraq, which took him to Ramadi, Baghdad, and Fallujah, he retired from the Marine Corps in 2006. Now, what I found interesting about Applegate, and the reason I wanted to bring him on this podcast, is that on the issues, he's very progressive. He's not the typical deep triple C Democratic Party. Let's go out and find a guy in a uniform who has medals that we can show about and show him in combat and roll him out because he'll be a quote unquote moderate Democrat and therefore will appeal to whatever that means to be the center of the political spectrum, which, as we have learned, is a lot of bull. He actually supports the hike in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. He opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and he says, and I'm quoting now from his website, "The moral and business imperative of single-payer universal health care is self-evident worldwide." So I caught up with Doug as he was driving on the campaign trail. So if you were to be elected to Congress, one of the things you would obviously deal with is the defense budget. And given your military background, your experience out there in the field, it strikes me that there's one thing that both parties have done over the course of a long time, which is support military budgets. Sometimes, if they don't necessarily make sense, partly for parochial reasons of defense installations, jobs locally, and I know that's a big challenge. And for example, in the recent congressional vote on the $700 billion defense budget, it was overwhelmingly bipartisan. There were only 70 members of Congress that voted against a budget that included, and I thought this was somewhat humorous, 20 more F-35 Joint Strike Fighters than the Pentagon even requested. So I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
I think the biggest problem that always arises with defense spending is Congress does not look at defense budgets from the standpoint of national defense. They always increase them for several different reasons. The primary one is to bring home pork to their district. Mm-hmm. Employment, money, contracts. The defense industry are pretty sly about this. They make sure that defense contracts impact each of the 50 states. That's the incentive that always skews to a default decision of more, not less, with respect to defense budgets. It drives the Pentagon up the wall as well, because seldom does a defense budget go through Congress without additional pork being added. And I also think that there's a there's a guilt complex with Congress that if veterans want to prove their patriotism by ensuring that they give the military more, not less. And I think that's one of the shortcomings of not having as many veterans in Congress.
Mm-hmm. So, Doug, do you think, given that we just talked about the budget of the Pentagon, the more important question is, you know, how over a long time Democrats have tried to mimic Republicans on being, you know, hawks on defense, but have really abandoned the conversation about what a true national defense looks like?
Oh, I think without question that the Democrats have ceded the field in national defense to Republicans for no good reason. For no good reason. I think that the Democrats would be far better served if they actively recruited young Iraq and Afghanistan veterans to run as challengers to Republicans, because they understand the ground truth of what these wars that have affected their generations more than anybody else mean. And why the Democrats have just basically waved the white flag in national defense is beyond me.
And whether they've either waved the white flag or they've tried to mimic it and be Republican light. And I think even, frankly, Barack Obama, and they're cozying up with the Saudis and supporting, you know, certain military adventures abroad. It just doesn't seem to me that there's a idea, and you point this out on your website, that war is not the answer in most respects. And what you said as we discussed this, that the diplomacy part is very, very important to that.
It's essential to any type of military force. And military force threatened is far more effective in 90% of the time than the application of military force.
Now, you could argue that certainly if you look at Republicans, it would be fine if they felt that they had to support the military, but why not do it when it comes to veterans' pay and pensions, and not to mention the funding of the VA, not just giving them weapon systems that they don't even need?
Well, I think I would default to my favorite quote from Smedley Butler, "War is a racket." Mm-hmm. You can make more money by spending it on weapons and weapon systems than you can by doing the right thing and honoring the promises made by the government to veterans. I think history has proven that fact, not just in the United States, but in most countries.
And as a veteran yourself, you can have that conversation with ease with perhaps many of your potential constituents. And do you find that to be something that resonates with them, that they understand that war is a racket and that, you know, money should be spent at least on veterans, the VA, but not necessarily on wasteful weapon systems? Do they see that happening?
I would be hesitant to use the term with ease mm-hmm. in any portion of a political endeavor, but
a wise man.
I would definitely say that veterans see the world through the same eyeglass that I look through. I think that if you have people that have served in combat, they look at the world much more critically. And I grew up in a household where my father was a combat veteran of World War II, was wounded twice in the Ardennes in 1944. And the only discussions we ever had about his experience was a rhetorical question that I knew as a young lad, no further discussion was necessary, was anybody who talks about combat hasn't seen it. And I think that the American public has been sold and resold a bill of goods that somehow military force and kinetic operations is the answer to solving the world's problems, when you really can't kill your way out of most of the problems that this world in the present context faces. We are killing more and more people and creating more and more enemies in the process.
Well, certainly the Iraq War is a great example of that. I mean, to shorten the story, the Iraq War essentially bred and created ISIS. If you look at the progression of activities and circumstance that happened once the war was initiated and you look down the road?
I think most people that served in Iraq foresaw that there would be a just a simple, to put it simply, another iteration of Al-Qaeda, which was a brand of Sunni Islam that arose as Wahhabis when the Turks controlled Mecca.
And you, to your point, we created more enemies and continue to create enemies every day with this kind of notion, as you point out, that we think, and I say we, meaning our political leaders think, that you can fight your way out of these problems using military force.
Correct. Even the Pentagon doesn't believe that, because in any of our planning, we always consider the dime concept, diplomacy, intelligence, military, and economic leverages. Military is only one of four principles in conducting any type of operation.
Right.
And I think that most people in the that are professional military officers, and as well as professional staff NCOs, recognize, once again, we can't kill our way out of the problem. And we aren't asking the right questions or using the right metrics to evaluate what success would be either.
What are the questions you ask?
I would always ask of the right people, what's the cost in blood, treasure, and duration?
Mm-hmm.
If there is a potential, as there usually is, of victory followed by insurgency and asymmetrical warfare, guerrilla warfare, to make it even more simple, you can count on a duration of two generations. So whenever we're considering military options, the duration would be the lives of your children and grandchildren. History is borne that out.
Now, you could argue, and I'm curious what your view is about this, that this all circles back, if we're looking at war in the Middle East, certainly circles back to the Israel-Palestine issue. What's your view about that?
Well, it absolutely applies to the war in the Middle East, which would encompass the Palestinian issue, which the only viable hope is a two-state solution, which is constantly undercut by one side or the other, or people that should be leading the peace process, or our third-party states like the United States, and certainly the rest of the Middle East, which is largely driven by natural resources, primarily carbon fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always lead with a world that was 100% renewable energy-based would be a more peaceful world. And that's something we need to strive for. And I think the first thing that every legislature should swear an allegiance to is to stop subsidies for oil production. The people that I've been talking to that are international sustainability consultants with, you know, conservative firms like Deloitte, believe primarily just on return of investment forces of the market without oil subsidies that we could be at 100% renewables within 10 years. Nobody really talks about that, not even the politicians that claim to be environmentalists. I think we're missing an opportunity of how quickly technology is scaling. And I would point to Scotland, who only recently announced that they planned on being 100% renewable energy based in 2 years. And the Scots own the rights to the North Sea oil field.
Right. So to underscore this, what you just said, cut off the subsidies, we get to 100% renewable.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a.
And that was not a pivot. I want to emphasize, Jonathan, that was not a pivot from the military issues and military defense.
No, I get that, absolutely.
That was very much connected people that I speak to every day are the special operations Marines and soldiers that know why they're still deploying at an obscene rate, and that is for oil. And I don't think Americans realize that.
And I assume that you underscored the special operations folks and so on because Camp Pendleton is in your district.
I would anyway, yeah, regardless whether or not Camp Pendleton is there, but Camp Pendleton is important to the demographics of this district because there's 50,000 veteran households.
Sure,
those aren't active duty Marines,
sure,
but those are veteran households that are voters.
Yep.
And I know from being an attorney, a trial attorney, in the area for going on four decades, that 90% plus of those veteran households are Marine veterans. Mm-hmm. So there's a special connection.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I meant that as just a factual thing,
yeah,
and that makes total sense that,
yeah,
you would be connecting with those folks in the district, given your background, but also because they're there, they're voters.
Absolutely.
And there's two other things that struck me about your district. One is that, at least when I looked this up, 25% of the voters, or at least the residents of the district, are Hispanic. And I'm curious whether you're seeing any difference in their engagement or interest in the race, for example, compared to 2016 when you ran last time, partly because of Donald Trump's antipathy and hostility towards immigrants.
I would certainly hope so. I don't know what their motivation is, but I can tell you this, that I'm the only candidate that routinely is stopped on the street and people tell me, whether they be Marine veterans, Latinos, Latinas, that, hey, Colonel, I voted for you. You should have won. I'm going to vote for you again. We'll get him this time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's anecdotal, but I think that the polls are also showing something similar. This will be a unique race.
Mm.
Some say this will be the marquee congressional race in the country. I really don't care whether or not it's a marquee race. What's important to me is representing the people of the 49th, both veteran, Hispanic, everyone. And I think one of the things that frustrates me is I'm a Democrat because I've always believed Democrats were the party for the working families, mm, the middle class of America, the workers. And I think that Democrats have stopped talking to the working people of America. I think that's why we ended up with Donald Trump.
Well, part of it is he used racism and bigotry very, very effectively. There's no question about that. When you look at the polling data, racism and bigotry was powerfully used by him. But certainly in industrial Midwest states, for example, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, he effectively used his opposition to NAFTA to rally at least enough people, I think, to vote for him in those key states, which he won. And I assume you're seeing the same thing in your district as well.
I'm seeing the same thing in both of those, because when you said Ohio, I grew up outside of Dayton, Ohio. Mm-hmm. I know the Middle West, mm-hmm, the Midwest. And I think no matter where you go, working families are wondering why the Democrats have deserted them. I constantly hear Democrats give their stump speeches. As a matter of fact, I probably have at least a dozen or so stump speeches from other Democrats that I know. And they are constantly omitting income disparity. And how can you talk about the U.S. economy without talking about income disparity? I don't know. I don't know.
And I assume that certainly to wrap up here, I assume that's largely you're motivated by that, by the politics of it, but your own experience in your family, where your mom owned a convenience store and your father worked a bread route, and he served, and I love this, he served as a union GM plant security officer. I'm a UAW member myself, so I assume that comes from your own experience in trying to listen to the voice of the working person.
Without question, my blue-collar upbringing made me who I am today. And I always tell unions that I have an easy time talking to, that I'm not going to forget where I come from. No matter what else happens, I come from a Union family before I was even one of Uncle Sam's misguided children, the Marine Corps. And I think that both of those things have served me well in this political adventure, because I think people know that I'm not trying to be a politician. I'm trying to be what I've always been. I fought for people that were injured by the forces that are powerful, and I spent 32 years of my life active in the reserve defending the country, and I want to see change in Washington. And the change that I'm talking about is not a rhetorical change. I list the results. It's got to be for the working family, and it has to be away from unauthorized use of military force. I cannot fathom how Congress has not stood and voted by roll call on the military action that we've taken since 9/11. There's been one, and both Democrat and Republican presidents have used that AUFM for everything we've done, and I think that's one of the reasons why our democracy has been undercut, because the Constitution has become a matter of convenience or inconvenience, followed when it's convenient, discarded when it's inconvenient.
Now it's time for our Robert Barron segment. And you know, sometimes even I'm amazed when I read and research a Robert Barron. Sometimes I'm even amazed by the greed of these Robert Barons, the chutzpah of these Robert Barons to shovel so much wealth into their pockets at the expense of the workers of the company and of society. And so today let's consider the obscene amount of money likely to be pocketed by a man named Mark Bertolini. Now, Bertolini is the CEO of Aetna, Inc. Yes, that's the same Aetna that has bankrupted thousands of people. Lord knows how many families basically went bankrupt because they had been charged outrageous prices for Aetna healthcare premiums. Not to mention people who may have died because Aetna denied them coverage and denied them the kind of care they needed to save themselves. Now, you may have heard that Aetna is proposing to merge with CVS Healthcare Corporation, the company that operates pharmacies. And if the $69 billion deal does go through, Bertolini is going to walk away, are you sitting down for this one, with about $500 million. $500 million, just for himself. Now, the big money that he's going to pocket is coming from the shares he owns in the company. And that is why I often point out when we talk about robber barons and CEO greed, that that's where the big money in CEO compensation is hidden, not in their weekly or biweekly paycheck. It's in the shares they own, the stock options they get. And it's the reason they do everything possible to raise share prices, even if that might mean that you're going to cut workers' jobs, because share prices often go up because Wall Street loves it when you cut jobs and you become more, quote unquote, lean and mean. Now, this deal that was agreed to, the temporary deal, the proposed deal, was agreed to at a $207 a share deal price. And that would hand at that price, $230 million just in stock that he has vested rights in. On top of that, he already holds, separately and aside, Aetna stock that rings in at another $190 million at that same share prices on the proposed deal. And because that isn't enough, he's going to get somewhere between $60 and $85 million for what is known as a change in control package. And that's the kind of deal that a CEO cuts that gives them big money in case they lose their jobs because of a merger or a takeover. Now, I know that every one of you listening to this podcast has a similar deal, right? You're going to get millions of dollars if your job all of a sudden goes away because of some takeover or merger. That's just a normal thing that every regular rank and file worker gets. I assume you get the sarcasm. Now, of course, this is an outrage. This is a blood-sucking company that literally has caused financial calamity to tens of thousands of people, and no doubt the deaths of other people who could not pay their outrageous premiums. And for that reason, Bertolini is the robber baron of the week. And that'll do it for this week's podcast. I want to thank my guests, Catherine Rodriguez and Doug Applegate. Our audio editor is, as usual, the awesome David Hebden. Please do subscribe to the podcast, and please do become a financial subscriber, especially during this holiday time. If you're thinking about where to spend those last few dollars on a good cause, on a charity, on something that will support really good work and bring information to people all around the country and even globally, make a contribution, become a financial supporter, a regular supporter. You can do all that at workinglife.org. Click on the podcast tab. We'll look forward to having you back next week.